Okay, let's go ahead and get started. So, quick announcement. This thing is going to go away, right? It's time. Homework one is posted on the course website. Hopefully you've all had a chance to look at that. It's due at the start of class on Friday. It's four problems, entirely kind of review thing, setting the frame for what we'll be talking about. It's like I'm not going to lose it. Unmute. There we go. Okay. So last time we were nearing the end of talking about this example simulation of a boost converter. We looked at it under some different operating modes, showed first what happens when it hard switches with the PN diode, then how we can eliminate reverse recovery with the Schottky diode, and then went further eliminating additional switching losses by going over into what is essentially a special case of DCM type operation, where we allowed very large ripple in the inductor current that allowed the inductor current to go negative just prior to when we want to turn the MOSFET on. And by carefully timing it out when the current goes negative, we get a resonance between parasitic capacitance here at the switch node and our main inductor. That resonance can bring the VDS of the MOSFET down to zero, and then we can turn on the MOSFET with zero VDS, thus eliminating this energy loss mechanism. We have this 1/2 CV squared. I think I've thrown the term out in lecture, but may not have formally defined it. We call this zero voltage switching, or ZVS. The idea is that we want to get the voltage to zero before we turn on the device, so we don't have that energy loss mechanism where we short out a cap, lose whatever it had stored. ZVS is one type of soft switching, as I've labeled it here. Another being ZCS, zero current switching, which is to say we reduce the current through a switch to zero prior to turning it off. Okay. Not as necessary in MOSFETs, being majority carrier devices, but ZCS is a big thing in IGBTs, PN diodes, things that have that stored minority charge. We'd like to ramp the current down to zero, allow that stored minority carrier charge to recombine, and then shut it off. We can eliminate reverse recovery in PN diodes, current tailing in IGBTs, really two sides of the same coin. Eliminate, or at least significantly reduce, with zero current switching. So we went on, we looked at the synchronous case, replacing the Schottky with the MOSFET, which gave us a little bit more control, a little bit better ability to maintain nice switching behaviors as we ramp down power, and also improve the efficiency a little bit, largely not due to switching losses, largely just due to replacing a VF with an R on and our conduction losses. Okay. And then the last thing we looked at was this really quasi-resonant converter, where we had, instead of just a short resonance during the switching time and otherwise square wave waveforms, we now have a full kind of half period of a resonance. The entire time the MOSFET is off, the circuit is resonating. This would be what we call a quasi-resonant converter, meaning that it's resonant during part of the switching period, but more than just at the edges of a PWM waveform. A full resonant converter would be something that's just sinusoidal waveforms that's resonating the entire time. We can construct a boost-like resonant converter. To do so requires a bit more permutations on the topology than what I did here, so we're going to leave that off for the moment, but we'll look more into resonant converters later in the course. Near the end of class, we started to just discuss a little bit about resonant circuits, remind you of the analysis, and then talk about the differences between what we'll be doing in this class and what you have seen in 481 if you took it here, or your own introductory power electronics course, assuming similar content. So before we could get away from doing all these differential equations by applying this small ripple analysis, saying that any of our energy storage elements are bulky and we're switching sufficiently fast relative to their resonant period that their value doesn't really change within one period. We can assume it's constant within one switching period and linearize the circuit based on that. Here, that's not going to be true. And depending on the type of circuit that we're looking at, if it's more of a soft switching circuit like the DCM boost, typical 481 type analysis will apply during most of the period, and we'll only have to look at the resonance during those switching transitions. If it's a quasi-resonant or a resonant converter, then we'll be kind of resonant during a majority or all of the period, and we'll have to be looking at the resonant equations for kind of the base operation. Then we started looking at resonant circuits in the time domain, kind of motivated the same difference by saying, really in 481, we had these type of resonances, but we were switching significantly faster than them. And so our converter had a fundamental frequency component at FS and harmonics out above it, but really nothing going on down here, right? No frequency content. We don't excite that resonance. In fact, we actively damp it through any kind of feedback control, so we didn't have to worry about it. Now in 581, if we're talking about a resonant converter, our switching frequency might be exactly F0. It's probably somewhere in the vicinity of it. If we are talking about just a DCM boost, another type of soft switching, but not the quasi or fully resonant converter, then we may still have a switching frequency out here, but we'll have dynamics down here due to these kind of long switching intervals. So mostly as review, I plotted the frequency response of this circuit. Down here, I want to look at the time domain response of our LCR filter here. So I'm going to look versus time, and what I'm going to look at is V out, and I'm going to assume V in is some step, and look at the step response of the circuit at V out. So what do I expect to see? This thing should rise up. I'll assume zero initial conditions everywhere. And at DC, if I put 1 volt DC on the input after a long time, after time goes to infinite on my step function, I should see 1 volt DC on the output, right? So how does it get there? Well, it really depends on the characteristics of this. What is the Q? What is the output resistance? And what is the characteristic impedance of the L and C? So if I have very small Q, I would expect to see something that looks like an overdamped system, rises up and settles without any overshoot. This would be for the case of Q is less than 0.5. As I increase Q, I'll move into a critically damped system for Q is equal to 0.5. As I continue increasing, what I'm going to see is this circuit will ring out at the resonant frequency of the circuit given by omega naught, which is 2 pi f naught. And as I continue increasing with Q approaching infinity, this thing is just going to ring with a perfectly drawn sinusoid. So this one is my Q approaches infinity. So for our situation, what's desirable? Previously in 481, we'd like, at least through control, all of our cues to be well damped. When we started thinking about closed loop response, we don't want any ringing. We want to suppress this, have a fast dynamic response, but no ringing. When we start talking about resonant converters, what we want is very high Q, because we're transferring all of our energy through this ringing process. Q, in addition to describing the ringing on the same side, it is describing the energy losses in the circuit. When I put it in a step response, I've got a fixed amount of energy that's ringing back and forth between L and C. And as this amplitude of the ringing dies out, that means more and more of that energy is dissipated somewhere. Okay. If R is my load, maybe that's okay. But if R is some parasitics of the circuit, and I start saying, I hit this circuit with an impulse, I want it to ring out to transfer energy, and all of that energy is being dissipated cycle by cycle, I'm not going to have a very high efficiency converter. Let's see, so that would be my voltage, my current for this circuit. If I added some extra axes here, the DC value of the inductor current, IL, depends really on the DC solution, which would be dictated by R. So I'll just plot one case where R goes to infinity. R goes to infinity, that is my Q is equal to infinity case, and this thing should just ring out. My inductor current will be zero centered, and it'll be out of phase with the voltage, right? So I should see, I'll give myself a chance to line this up. My inductor current hits zero at each of the peaks, and so on. So particularly in this Q is equal to infinity case, there is a fixed amount of energy ringing back and forth in this circuit, right? And it's energy going from my capacitor to my inductor and back. So if I look at these zero crossings, at the zero crossings, I have no energy in my inductor. That's when I have peak energy in the capacitor. My zero crossing of the capacitor voltage, I have zero energy in the capacitor. I have the DC amount, but I have none from this ringing. That corresponds to my maximum energy in the inductor. So this resonant ringing, really a transfer of energy back and forth between the two elements. I can shift the amplitude of, for example, this inductor current by changing the magnitude of the inductance. If I want to keep a constant resonant frequency, if I want to double the inductance, I'd have to half the capacitance, keep my resonant frequency constant, but by doubling that inductance, I'm going to decrease the amplitude of this ringing, because my energy as it goes into the inductor, I'm going to have 1/2 Li squared. If I increase inductance, I decrease the amplitude of that ripple for that same amount of energy. So by design of these elements, I can kind of control the amplitude and wave shape of this ringing. And we're going to very shortly be digging into why that's important and how to shape these things so that, for example, this half sinusoid of the inductor current will give me enough change in voltage to achieve my soft switching in a circuit. How do I design that? And how do I analyze how that affects converter operation? Okay. So that's the end of looking into this example simulation. Kind of to summarize this idea of soft switching and really the zero voltage switching that we've looked into, whether it be just a soft switching converter, quasi-resonant or resonant. It has advantages in reducing switching loss, which we saw. It allows us to get to higher switching frequency for a couple of reasons. The first is that first bullet, by reducing switching losses and making sure we can maintain reasonable efficiency and reasonable thermals. The other, which I didn't belabor so much, but looking at something like this resonant converter, we kind of mentioned, well, the series inductance on a MOSFET and the parallel capacitance, those are both generally quantities to be minimized. Those are parasitics of the circuit. In this converter, I increased them intentionally and incorporated them into its base operation. Now they're no longer parasitic elements. Now they're part of how it's intended to operate. And as I go to higher and higher switching frequency, the just base parasitics of a MOSFET are going to become more significant, and I'm going to have no choice but to incorporate them into my normal operation. If I try to neglect them, I'm going to get huge ringing that I didn't want. There's no way around it. So another way that it's allowing me to get to higher switching frequency is by actually intentionally incorporating parasitics. Into my operation, in addition to just reducing loss. And then the last one there, it's possible to really improve EMI through these converters by going from a hard switch converter where I have square wave like waveforms to either a soft switch converter where I have slowed edges, slowed rise and fall times on those waveforms, or a fully resonant converter where I'm nearly single frequency in my spectrum, just resonating at the characteristic frequency of that resonance. But disadvantages, operating in this resonant manner is going to increase stresses really throughout the converter. And that's because I need to have this amount of circulating current in my, for example, my DCM boost. I went from my inductor currents, IL in the PWM case looked something like this. In the DCM zero voltage switching case, it looked something like this, where I had least double the peak current, so that I could end up with the same average while still coming down and hitting zero. So in the PWM case, I had IL peak and IL RMS both pretty much just equal to IL. IL being my average input current, it is whatever it needs to be to give me the power I'm trying to convert. In the DCM case, IL peak is 2IL, IL RMS is 2 over root 3. IL for this triangle wave. So that's the same power for the same average value of my input current. I now have higher peak stresses and higher RMS stresses. This is going to contribute to additional conduction losses throughout the converter. This is going to contribute to needing to pick higher rated components. Which potentially also will be a detriment. Now I'll need a bigger MOSFET to handle all this current. That MOSFET might have more capacitance than the one I could get away with in the PWM case. Similar things are true for voltage. If we look at the quasi-resonant boost converter, drain to source voltage, the peak stresses were 120 volts versus 48 in the non-resonant case. This is something that could be controlled and tuned with different resonant components, as we were just discussing here. But no matter what, my stresses are going to increase. Particularly true in that case, 130 volts, I probably need a 200 volt MOSFET at least, versus a 60 volt MOSFET that I might have been able to get away with in the PWM case. That higher voltage MOSFET is going to have higher on resistance, kind of worse parameters. And the last disadvantage is the one that won't be a disadvantage in December for you guys, is they're a little bit more complex to model and to analyze, but we'll solve that in this class. So no problem there. Okay. Questions on that? Yeah.
So if you're going to the same average plant, then why is the IL automatic
system? So RMS is a averaging of the square of the current. So it's going to, anytime, you know, the lowest RMS is going to be just DC. Anytime you get the same DC with some ripple on it, the RMS is going up. And it's because of that, you know, the average is weighted linearly with the value. RMS is weighted with the square. So I have to go equally over and under, but this is going to count more because I'm squaring it. All right, a couple practical things in the next few slides that I'm just going to mention. Things that are going to come into play and limit us on where we can go with this. So now we're soft switching, we're eliminating a lot of switching losses. Can we just take this thing out to infinite frequency? The answer, of course, is no, and there's going to be certain limitations that maybe weren't important previously when we were hard switching at a lower switching frequency, but as we start pushing this design further and further, they're going to come into play. So the first one I'm mentioning is limitations due to the gate drive of my active switches. This is one that we'll talk about in a lot more detail just following this, but if I look at my circuit, this being a model of my power MOSFET, only concerning with the parasitics that might affect the gate drive. I'll have some gate resistance and some gate to source capacitance. My gate drive is just functionally some buffer. But internal to that buffer, the way that it is outputting either high or low is really going to be a pair of FET type devices. S1 turns on, I pull the gate high. S2 turns on, I pull the gate low. Okay. This thing here is really the same half bridge that we've been looking at. At least in the synchronous case, the boost converter that we've been looking at, still just two stacked devices. I turn on one, I turn on the other. Okay. And the boost converter that we were looking at, we had an inductor tied to it. We found that if that inductor current is in the right polarity, I can use it to eliminate any kind of switching losses and resonantly charge and discharge any capacitance tied to this node. Here, there's no inductance. And further, there's a capacitance attached to that node. So this thing is now going to be its own hard switching half bridge. And I'm going to have this CV squared type of loss from charging and discharging this capacitance every period. And I'm going to end up with losses now back on my gate drive due to that hard charging and discharging. I'm going to end up with a gate drive power loss, which looks like some energy that is supplied to the gate and pulled back from the gate times FS. This is now another switching type loss proportional to switching frequency here. From an example application node of a gate driver, just showing that this loss is proportional to switching frequency. As I go up higher and higher, I get more and more loss, and eventually this could be a problem. The other part of this is that I have some RC characteristic at the gate of the power MOSFET that takes time to rise, time to fall. And if I start pushing the switching frequency out to the point where the switching frequency is comparable to the time constant of that RC, that means that during a significant portion of the period, I'm in the process of switching, neither on nor off. I would like that to be approximately 0% of the period, you know, 0.1%, something very small. But if it becomes 50% of the period, means or two of them in a period, it means I never really get on, never really fully turn off. I'm always somewhere in the middle, and I'm not even going to be able to describe my power MOSFET as an open or an R-on. I'm going to have to always describe it as somewhere in between. It's not going to behave like a switch. That can limit how high we can go with switching frequency, either from the power loss on the gate drive or on the FET if it's switching too slow. Okay. And this is really expanding upon that point. I call this the TD over TS ratio, TD being short for dead time or the time it takes to complete a switching action. This is actually, even if the gate drive is very fast, but I'm having these resonant type switching transitions, the gate drive can be fast, but it still takes time for me to get that ZVS. So what I'm plotting is waveforms for a boost converter, VDS of the low side and the inductor current, and I plot versus a normalized time where the right side of the axis is the switching period, should be 2 microseconds for 500 kilohertz, 1 microsecond for a megahertz, 0.5 microseconds for 2 megahertz. And what you see is, compared to the 500 kilohertz case, 2 megahertz case, this really same resonance takes longer to complete. It's really taking roughly the same amount of time, but the switching period is condensed, so it's a larger percentage of my total period. Okay. So as FS goes up, this TD over TS is going to increase. Here's my TD at 500 kilohertz. Here's my TD at 2 megahertz. Okay, why is this a problem? Well, during this resonant time, the inductor current is circulating into these parasitic capacitances to charge and discharge them, which means that during this time, that inductor current is not going to the output, not providing power at the output. Okay? So I am cutting off and creating zero output current during some significant portion of this period. If I want to get the same total output power, that means during the remainder of the period, I'm going to have to have higher current. Okay? Instead of delivering, this is all a 150 watt case. So instead of delivering 150 watt over a full period, I'm delivering 150 watt in 60% of the period. I'm going to need more current during that 60%. I need 40% more current. So you see, as I go from the 500 kilohertz case to the 2 megahertz case, I end up with higher peak currents to still deliver the same amount of power. Okay. So this trade-off is somewhat generally true of soft switching converters, that even to the extent that the soft switching is ideal and I eliminate switching losses, it's going to reflect back, cause more conduction losses in order to get that extra circulating current to obtain soft switching. So no free lunch. These are experimental waveforms for the same converter. My last few slides today will talk about this experimental platform, just as an example. Next limitation is thermal, which comes into play as I continue pushing up switching frequency, presumably because my goal is to reduce the size of the system. I want to go higher and get the size of my passes down. As I go up in switching frequency, my losses are going to get worse. If I, you know, for a set topology and a set way of operating it, whether it's soft switching or not, no matter what, as I go up in switching frequency, things are going to get worse, either by a little or by a lot. And if I am doing this effectively, if I'm going up in switching frequency for the purpose of getting smaller, and my losses are increasing and my size is going down, so I'm going to have a lot more energy and a lot smaller space. It's going to be harder to cool this thing. Okay. So if I have a 100 kilowatt converter and I'm 99% efficient, I've got a kilowatt of loss, my converter is this big, I've got a kilowatt distributed over this whole space. I go up in switching frequency and make it this big. Now dissipating a kilowatt of energy from this size is a lot more difficult. I'm showing some analysis from an example reference. Generally, one way to analyze this is what's called a Pareto front, which is an optimization technique where we look at the trade-off between different variables that we want to optimize. We look often at this called an eta alpha Pareto front. Eta is the efficiency of the converter. Alpha is the power density. In units of kilowatts per liter or some kind of watt per volume. The reason we look at power density is because it's something we want big. We want efficiency to be large. We want power density to be large. We want volume small. This allows us to look at two things we want to be big. So where I'm trying to push this thing is towards the top right. I want high efficiency. I want high power density. So if I look at an example design and I kind of fix my topology, fix my switching scheme, but allow myself to change the values I choose for the passive, for the devices, and the switching frequency. What's going to happen is I'm going to start with a point here, which is my very low switching frequency, very large passive design. If I let all my inductors be real huge, all my caps be huge, I should be able to get very low loss on them. Maybe I parallel up 20 devices, but my R-on is low and I switch it 100 hertz so that the switching losses don't matter. I should be able to get the efficiency very high in a given design. And then I'm going to begin from that point increasing switching frequency. What that's going to allow me to do is reduce the size of those passives. And I'm going to kind of move in this direction. And I'm assuming the way I'm building this converter doesn't change. I'm not jumping to soft switching suddenly or changing the topology. It's kind of a fixed design. I'm just changing the devices and the switching frequency. So as I go up, I'm going to get more losses, but I'm going to get smaller much more rapidly than I get more losses. Okay? Because I've made this thing so huge that switching losses were 0.1% of total losses. So if I double the switching frequency, my size goes down a lot. Now they're 0.2% of losses, but still doesn't really impact things. And I'm going to continue going up in switching frequency, taking a small hit in losses, but getting big benefits in size. Eventually, these switching losses, however, are going to take over, and I'm going to start to see this roll off. And somewhere out here, I'm going to see my smallest design. As I go along this line, I am increasing switching frequency. I'm continuing. Eventually, the switching losses start to become very significant. I'm still getting some benefit in power density, But at some point I hit a wall where increasing the switching frequency any further, I've just got way too much heat in this very small size, and I'm going to have to use a bigger heat sink now to get all that heat out. And the total size of the system is going to start to increase again, mainly due to thermal, but also potentially due to magnetics having too much loss and needing to make them larger because of the high switching frequency. So this segment down here, definitely not something you want to design. You could get the same power density with lower losses. But anywhere on this top part between my original point and my smallest design, which one is the best? Well, it depends on how much you care about power density, how much you care about efficiency. And then everywhere in here are achievable designs. Anything not on this top curve is suboptimal by definition. I can do better without sacrificing. You know, if I'm here, I can choose to do better in efficiency at the same power density, or do much better in power density at the same efficiency. Once I'm up on that curve, I can only improve one by sacrificing in the other. And that's the concept of this Pareto optimization. Is you're really finding the front where improving efficiency only possible with a hit in power density, or the other way around, where it's impossible now to improve one parameter without some detriment to the other. Okay. He said, so this would be the front for my hard switching converter. If I went and looked at the DCM boost, it would have some different curve here. And that curve might be something like this. Just a guess on my part, the reason I drew it this way, at very large size, low switching frequency, I am going to take a bigger hit because I have these higher RMS currents that I mentioned. But it's going to be less sensitive to switching frequency as I start minimizing it, which should stay flatter than the red one, allow me to get out the higher switching frequency without running into this this limit in terms of power density. And be a more practical design if I'm trying to get out here. Okay. This would be my example of a ZVS, be my example of a hard switching. Okay. Does that make sense? Okay, other limitations. Magnetics design is not going to be a focus of this course, but it's something we need to be aware of. If we take the simple approach, we can use the Steinmetz equation for core loss. Our core loss is KFE delta B to the beta, FS to the alpha times the volume of the core. Steinmetz parameters taken from a data sheet here show that for a fixed delta B, as I go up in frequency, I get a very significant increase in the core loss per unit volume. Alpha, approximately 2 to 3, maybe a little higher. So as I double switching frequency, I might get a factor of 4 to maybe even 8 in the core losses per unit volume. Some of that will get diminished if I can get smaller, but generally these are going to get worse as I go to higher frequency. The benefit, here's a transformer design optimization. details of which aren't so important as the general trend that as my switching frequency increases, I'm able to get to lower core volume. At lower switching frequency, I'm stuck using larger cores. And it just really to prevent saturation and optimize losses on this thing. But as I continue going up in switching frequency, eventually my core losses are getting very large. In addition to just the trend I mentioned here, these parameters, beta, alpha, to some extent, KFE, are all functions of frequency, get worse at high frequency. Fortunately, very nonlinear, which is a limitation of applying this equation. So that increase is going to get even worse. After I move into the megahertz range, into the tens of megahertz and above, there's really no ferrite type core material that can handle that level of frequency with small losses. Eventually, I'm going to start to move over to air core inductors, which are going to be problematic. I can't get very much inductance, and I've got nothing to contain the flux, nothing to stabilize the inductance of that device. Also, as I go up to higher switching frequency, things like skin effect, proximity effect, fringing field, get worse or more significant at higher switching frequency. So I may not be able to actually implement the design at once. As I get the higher switching frequency, the magnetics may be prohibitively lossy. That'll be another limitation. Last one here in terms of circuit modeling. In this class, we're largely going to consider kind of one parasitic behavior at a time, assuming the rest of the set is ideal. When we look at a real power MOSFET, we have all of these different parasitics all at once. I've got inductances of any connection. I've got capacitances between any two connections. I have nonlinearities of every element included. Capacitors, their capacitance varies with voltage, inductances change with current, everything changes with temperature. Even with all these parasitics included, the MOSFET itself is a nonlinear element, jumping between these different operating modes and having characteristic curves. There have been attempts at solving out circuits with complete parasitics to date, even in kind of the literature. Those attempts have not yielded any universally applicable circuit model that can describe switching loss behaviors in hard switch circuits. Giving a reference of one example model that tried to include all these inductances and capacitances and comparing experimental results to their proposed model, that there's still significant error even after pages of equations trying to solve exact time domain models of this. Okay. So more often than not in hard switch converters, rather than trying to model all of this, we just use empirical models, switch it, measure what the losses were. That's your model now. Should be pretty accurate. But it does little for you in the way of helping you design the next version, helping you select a new FET if you can only model with one you've already measured. So this is not a problem with a simple solution, but one approach is to try to eliminate the effect of many of these parasitic elements, right? Either by incorporating them into circuit operation or operating in a way that any resonances they cause don't get excited. Okay. So one option is to move to something like a soft switching converter, where instead of having square wave currents that will excite any parasitic LC resonance, I have slowed transitions. Those now allow the currents in all these inductances to change slowly. They pull all the energy back from the capacitance. They reduce my frequency content, so that the effect of many of these parasitics is negligible. Okay. mine. Okay, to wrap up today, I just wanted to give an experimental example similar to what we've been looking at. It's going to be a kind of boundary DCM boost converter. The ratings are a little bit different. This was a 150 to 400 volt, 150 watt boost converter. This was part of research that was examining the reverse recovery behavior of various types of diodes. So it's going to look at a silicon PN diode, a silicon carbide, Schottky, and then a GaN. Actually, I don't think I included the slides on the GaN just because describing what that diode is would have taken me half the class. So we're just going to look at these two actually in these slides. So the silicon PN diode, looking at first, this is operating in this DCM type mode of operation where I allow the inductor current to go negative, have a nice resonance that gives me a sinusoidal transition on my MOSFET VDS. Not so important for what we're doing in the class, but as an interesting side note, for a PN diode, there is still reverse recovery going on. And you see that in these waveforms here, looking at inductor current and drain to source voltage. You see that the inductor current hits zero and then has to continue negative some amount before the voltage starts to change. This is that reverse recovery behavior. The diode does not turn off when the current hits zero. Instead, it has to ramp a little bit past. But the effect is greatly reduced because of my very slow DISDT. When we looked at reverse recovery, we saw the reverse recovery charge and time are proportional to the ramp rate of the current. By going to this mode of operation, it's very slow, and I have very little negative current versus, I've got maybe 2 amps, half an amp, looking at the wrong thing, versus 50 amps that I get if I tried to hard switch this thing. There is increased conduction loss by about 30%. That 30% comes from root 2 over 3 is 1.1 something. You square it, 33%. So the conduction losses, when I do I squared R, the RMS current, should go up by a little more than 30%. So there's this operation. It's nice soft switching. When we look at the loss breakdown, even though it's soft switching, I still have some reverse recovery losses at 100 kilohertz. Those reverse recovery losses are 21% of the total loss. These remaining portions of the pie are just conduction losses in the inductor, MOSFET, and diodes. As I go to 1 megahertz, those reverse recovery losses scale with frequency and become my dominant loss mechanism now. Just the residual reverse recovery, even though I'm soft switching. My efficiency drops from 98% down to 95% due to this as I scale up in switching frequency. Then we replace this silicon PN diode with a silicon carbide Schottky. I apologize, I have the wrong symbol here. This is a Schottky diode. Around the room, I think everybody here should be familiar with wide band gap. Silicon carbide, a new semiconductor material, part of these wide band gap materials with superior characteristics to silicon. We'll do a little bit of analysis of that later on in the course. But it allows me to have a high voltage Schottky diode, and I can get rid of most of this reverse recovery type loss. That allows me to do is really have efficiency, which is more or less independent of switching frequency within some given range. That's what this is talking about. Only second order switching loss mechanisms remain. So all of the main things that I would analyze in a hard switch converter, the reverse recovery loss, the capacitive loss, those are more or less eliminated. Now there's these second order things. edge termination in the diode, parasitic inductances, those still exist. There'll still be some dependence on switching frequency, but allows me to jump, for example, from 1 megahertz to 2 megahertz with relatively little hit and efficiency, and 100 kilohertz to 1 megahertz, almost no change in efficiency. We've eliminated these dominant switching loss mechanisms. From here, we have now limitations cited in this study that are things like the limitations we just mentioned, the magnetics design at the higher frequency, the more complex switching loss mechanisms, and gate drive operation. So I just wanted to give some experimental examples showing these waveforms that we've been simulating. From here, a couple more slides, just showing kind of where things stand today in very high frequency power electronics. It's a study done at MIT where they looked at a 110 megahertz converter, a boost type converter. You see, as they go to these very high switching frequencies, they're adding resonances in the circuit, not only to get ZVS, a kind of first order switching loss mechanism, with secondary resonances to take care of the parasitic inductance, figuring out, now that I've eliminated this mechanism, what's the new dominant one, and how can I employ some resonance, employ some switching behavior to eliminate or mitigate that? So they're getting, you know, high 80% efficiency on their 110 megahertz converter, comparing it to what they call a conventional converter. I don't really agree with 85% being state-of-the-art for conventional converters, but 85% efficiency out of 110 megahertz was pretty good. Another study here looking at where can we go with hard switching converters, and this specifically was taking a gallium nitride device designed actually as an RF device and seeing how high we could push the switching frequency while hard switching. And we were able to go up to 50 megahertz without any problem, hard switching this device with some 28 volts on it. It was an interesting study because it was nearly impossible to figure out what was going on in the circuit because the drain to source capacitance of that GaN set was 2 picofarads, and the voltage probe we used to measure it was 4 picofarads. So we're tripling the capacitance by ever looking into what's going on. So you just turn it on and hope it's working okay. Okay, here's the list of topics covered in the course. This is also on the website. We will pick up with analysis of switching losses and then moving into the resonant case beginning next class. Okay. See you Wednesday.